and analysis on demand. This is PID Radio.
Catapult of propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Our guest is researcher and author Peter Goodgame, whose new book is Red Moon Rising, The Rapture and the Timeline of the Apocalypse. Peter, welcome back to PID Radio.
Hello, Derek and Sharon. It's nice to hear from you.
It's great to talk to you again. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Good.
Studying hard and trying to write every chance I get.
You know, Peter, you must study all the time because I read through your book, Red Moon Rising, and there is so much there. You have clearly not only done all the studying that everybody else who's written about, you know, the end times, quote unquote, has done, but you have also just put some things in there that stood me on end.
I am, you know, standing on the shoulders of those who came before me, and I build a lot of my chronology on you know, stuff that a lot of people have noted before me, but the way I put it together, I try and resolve some of the big arguments that are going on right now with regard to a number of these events, end times events, and how they fit into the timeline.
Well, it's fascinating reading. Before we get into the timeline, tell us a little bit about you so our listeners can sort of get an idea of how they relate to your experience, your salvation experience.
Well, a little bit about me. Well, I'm in Hawaii now, and I moved here with my family in 1986. I come from, both of my grandfathers are ministers of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Hmm. They're getting old now, but I'm not a Seventh-day Adventist. My dad is not a Seventh-day Adventist. My dad has thrown it all out. He doesn't believe any of it. But I was brought up in a Christian environment when I was real little. And then by the time I got to Hawaii, which was the beginning of high school, I kind of put all that stuff all behind me and focused on myself and on having fun. But sometime after that, after high school, is when I started to address some of the more profound issues just about, you know, the human experience. Mm-hmm. And this really, I think God was with me the whole time, even though I wasn't with him. And eventually I was brought back into the fold, and what helped me very much was the study of Bible prophecy itself, because I got a hold of an old paperback copy of a book by Arnold Fruchtenbaum, who's a Messianic Jewish teacher, very well respected, but very academic on the academic side. He has his own ministry, but he's one of the more serious Bible teachers. Anyway, his outline of Bible prophecy, according to the, you know, dispensational teachings, really opened my eyes and helped to just wake me up to what's happening and the plan that God has for this world.
It's a very workmanlike job that you've done in methodically going through and saying, okay, let's start with what we know as a foundation. You know, what's the most clear, and let's work forward from that.
Mm-hmm.
And you open up chapter one by saying there is a single prophecy that creates the foundation on which much of the framework of Bible prophecy can securely rest. What is that prophecy?
That is Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's hugely important because it pinpointed to the day, the first coming of the Messiah. And it also laid out a 7-year timeline, and this is the framework from which to begin to understand the end time prophecies of the Bible. It's what most people refer to as the 7-year tribulation. I think it's very important that people hang on to this and believe that it is true, because it's so important. If you don't have this to begin with, you're grasping at straws the rest of the way through, and you're floating free of anything concrete. It's real hard to develop a good exegesis of end times prophecy without that.
So where do we go from there? Once we've nailed down, okay, we know that Daniel 70 weeks is the framework on which we build, but obviously he wasn't talking about a literal 70 week period.
That's the big question. Where can we place the beginning, the middle, and the end of the 7 year period? Daniel himself, or the angel, explains that this 7 year period is divided in half by this event referred to as the abomination of desolation by Daniel and by Jesus, and then Paul mentions it also. And you find these references to this half of a seven-year period within the book of Revelation throughout, the 1260 days, 42 months, times, times, and half a time. That's a reference to a half of the seven-year period. So now just to explain how I arrived at my own unique conclusions about nailing down some of the points onto the timeline, let me just reference another thing that I was exposed to early on. This is something that emerged in the early 90s, I would say. The pre-wrath rapture, and a couple of the well-known promoters of this were Marvin Rosenthal and Robert Van Kampen. Are you guys familiar with this view?
Heard the names.
Yeah.
Well, the pre-wrath rapture, right now within evangelical Christianity, mainstream, in America at least, it's the chronology that's accepted is known as the pre-trib rapture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they say that if you look at Revelation, the church is raptured prior to any of this stuff happening. And they also place the beginning of the seven-year period at the opening of the first seal, and then place the beginning of the day of the Lord at the opening of the first seal. The pre-wrath rapture took issue with a lot of these pre-trib conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Their end result was placing the rapture at the very, very end of the seven-year tribulation. This meant this is a very important conclusion. It meant that Christians would have to face the Great Tribulation and the rise of the Antichrist and the mark of the beast, all of these things. So really, it doesn't create a bright outlook for Christians.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, in my examination of the pre-wrath rapture, I did see that. I disagree with this entirely. I disagree with the major pre-wrath conclusion entirely. Christians are not supposed to be preparing themselves for the Great Tribulation, or for the Antichrist, or anything of that sort. We're not supposed to be making physical preparations, which is what any, you know, father would do if he really truly believed that this is what was coming. If I knew that this was coming, you know, I'd be stocking up on food for one thing, and survival equipment, maybe even guns and ammunition. Who knows if it came to that point? The thing is, Jesus never said to prepare in that way.
Right.
So.
What he does say is when he's speaking in Matthew and he talks about the abomination of desolation, he says, wherever you are, run. He doesn't say, stop and get your wallet, get your purse, get some food.
Right.
In other words, he's saying, I'm
going
to take care of you. If I'm asking you to go through something, I will take care of you.
Yes, exactly. Aside from their major wrong conclusions, I do believe that the pre-wrath rapture brought forth some new and interesting interpretations that I believe made sense. So the way I see how the church accepted or looked upon this new theory arising, the way I look at it is the pre-wrath rapture is one step forward and two steps back. And the establishment threw the baby out with the bathwater, said, let's get rid of all of it. We don't want to look at this because its major conclusion is just too scary and too wrong. So all I have done is really tried to take what these scholars did do that was positive and try and use it and apply it and see if it helps to answer some of the questions and solve some of the problems that are obviously there within the pre-trib chronology. So where I begin to look at this and where I think the pre-wrath rapture view was correct and was doing a lot of good things was in relation to the studies on what's known as the Day of the Lord, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Day of the Lord is a time period, a period of divine judgment that is referred to throughout the Old and New Testament. There is literally hundreds of references to this event. On the other hand, there are three references to the Great Tribulation. So we cannot really develop an exegesis about the Great Tribulation as well as we can develop one on the Day of the Lord. And actually, once you develop the understanding of the Day of the Lord, then the understanding of the Great Tribulation comes very easily. Anyway, for me, the title of my book is based on prophecy given by Joel, chapter 2, verse 31.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about how the sun will be darkened and the moon will turn to blood
mm-hmm.
before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Now, that prophecy is shown fulfilled in the book of Revelation in the sixth seal, okay? And this is what the pre-wrath guys hit upon. And this is where the pre-trib guys had an objection. But I think the pre-wrath guys were right. This is where it was fulfilled. It was within the sixth seal, at the opening of the sixth seal.
Mm-hmm.
So the day of the Lord couldn't have begun at the first seal. It had to have begun after this time in the sixth seal. Now, if we look at the sixth seal, we find a list of five events, okay? First of all is a great earthquake. It doesn't say where, it just says a great earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a darkened sun, blood-red moon, a shower of falling stars, and then a great shaking of the earth. That's the final and major event. This is it. This is the beginning of the day of the Lord from my study. This, when the earth is shaken, and in Revelation it talks about how every island and mountain is moved from its place, and how the stars of the sky scroll.
Right.
Scroll. I think this is talking about the earth literally moving, shaking on its axis.
Reeling like a drunkard.
Yes, from Isaiah 24.
Uh-huh.
Almost like a pole shift sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yes, like a polar shift type of event. Now I find evidence that this is what begins the day of the Lord in Isaiah chapter 2, and it talks about the very same event, okay? And it says very specifically, this is a great shaking of the earth, and then it also refers to it as a day of the Lord event. So if the day of the Lord comes after the darkened sun and the blood red moon, and then we have this great shaking of the earth that is referred to as a day of the Lord event, this is where it all begins. This is where it happens. This is where the apocalypse begins. It's after the opening of the sixth seal. And this is proven by the widespread panic that follows. It's described in Isaiah chapter 2 and as a result of this shaking in Revelation itself. When people cry out and they run and flee to the mountains and the caves and they cry out mm-hmm. that the great day of God's wrath has come. So this is it. This is where it begins.
So they're going into their underground bunkers.
Yes, they're preparing for the end. And the other thing is this, when this happens, this will hit people on a number of levels, obviously physically, but also emotionally and spiritually. Everybody will know, and in every reference to that we have in the Bible of the beginning of this event, people know in their hearts that God has acted.
So now we've nailed down with the sixth seal.
That is the day of the Lord.
The beginning of
the day of the Lord. Now,
that does not equate, though, to the beginning of the 70th of Daniel's 70th
right.
week.
This does not equate to, we still haven't nailed down. In other words, the 7-year tribulation is still free floating. We haven't nailed it down. What I do in my book is I nail down the midpoint of the 70th week. And I think that's very easily done. I call this the benchmark of the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
We can nail the midpoint of the 70th week down very easily through what are described as the three woe judgments, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And after the death of the two witnesses, and then after they're resurrected, there's an earthquake in Jerusalem. This is 3.5 days after the midpoint, three and a half days after the midpoint of the 70th week, because the two witnesses witness in the first half, and then the beast from the abyss has power over the second half.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, after they're resurrected, the text says that that the second woe has passed, and the second woe is the sixth trumpet judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So the beginning is free floating, but the midpoint has to take place at the very end of the sixth trumpet judgment. Now, as far as the beginning of the apocalypse, I believe it's kind of a double impact event. The first impact is the day of the Lord's great shaking of the earth. Then there's a slight pause that's mentioned at the opening at the blowing of the seven trumpets. There's a pause mentioned there.
Right.
The second impact is the plagues that come from the four angels that harm the earth and the sea.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first four trumpets, okay? The first trumpet is the meteor impacts that bring hail, fire, and blood upon a third of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Second is this burning mountain thrown into the sea. The third is the star wormwood falling from heaven, water, and the water turns bitter. The fourth is the sun, moon, and stars darkened by a third. Mm-hmm. So I think this collection of these four angels that harm the earth and the sea, I view that as a unified sort of judgment. And I even believe that the 70th week, the seven-year period, does not even begin until after these four angels have done their, have, these judgments have fallen.
So I, so it gets worse.
Yeah. So I really put the beginning of the seven-year tribulation right close with the fifth trumpet judgment, which is the opening of the abyss. And that's something that I'm working on now. But I don't get into that in my book too much. And actually, in my book, I simply draw the line that it has to happen after the first trumpet. Now I'm really of the view that it has to happen after the fourth trumpet. Anyway, so yeah, you have a double impact. You have the shaking of the earth, you have a slight pause, and then you have this all these terrible things coming out of the sky, okay, whether they're meteors, burning mountains, or the star wormwood, and final result is that the atmosphere is darkened. Okay, this now to tie the seven-year period into these events, the beginning of the seven-year period, I turn to the Magog invasion of Ezekiel 38 and 39,
mm-hmm.
and I believe that that Ezekiel's descriptions of what happens at this time line up so perfectly with this understanding that I put forward of how the apocalypse begins. And let me just demonstrate. It also ties in very well with what Jesus and Paul had to say as well about how the apocalypse would begin. And here are the parallels. I'm just going to list them briefly that you find in Ezekiel and also in the New Testament, whether it be the book of Revelation, Paul, or Jesus. Okay, the first parallel is peace and safety. There's peace and safety. The earth will be existing in peace and safety prior to the beginning of the apocalypse. The second one, and you find this in the New Testament and in Ezekiel, Israel is living in peace and safety.
Right.
The second is sudden destruction. It all comes suddenly, okay? There's no, you know, really important signs or buildup of anything. And that's kind of how the pre-trib views it. They really think that, you know, the first four seals happen at the beginning of the seven-year period, and it grows in intensity until all of a sudden, you know, on down the line, the earth shakes. I don't fall in line with that view. I think the apocalypse begins in a period of peace and safety, and it begins with sudden destruction. The third parallel is a great earthquake. You find this as the first act of wrath that comes from God upon him witnessing the Magog invasion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great earthquake, and he says it takes place in Israel. If we turn to the sixth seal, that's the very first event. It's a great earthquake. It's a local earthquake. Revelation does not tell us where it happens. Ezekiel tells us it happens in Israel. The fourth parallel is the common reaction to all of these events. How do the people react to the beginning of the apocalypse? And let me just read. Ezekiel just says, all the people on the face of the earth will tremble at my presence. In Revelation, people cry out, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb.
Right.
For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? There's always a reference to God's wrath, and there's always, you know, there's a feeling of widespread panic. That's the fourth parallel. Okay, the fifth parallel is I got them mixed up. The fourth parallel is the common reaction. The fifth parallel is a reference to God's wrath. God's wrath announces the beginning of the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
To tie this in even better is that the double references to blood, hail, and fire coming from the sky, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the final judgments in Ezekiel upon the Magog invaders. And this is simply how I equate it. Ezekiel says, I'm quoting, I will execute judgment upon him with plague and bloodshed. I will pour down torrents of rain, hailstones, and burning sulfur. I believe this same event is described in Revelation when it says, talking about the first trumpet judgment, it says, the first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down upon the earth. So, again, I think the parallels are there. Now, how I tie in the 7 years is simply at the end of the Magog invasion, the cleanup procedures are described. There's a seven-month period for cleanup, and then there's a specific seven-year period when Israel uses some of the captured fuel supplies as a fuel source for 7 years.
Right, that's
I
true.
Think that, yeah, I think that 7 year period is not a coincidence. I think it means something.
Let me ask. Let me ask you a question that some of our listeners may be thinking as well right now. Where exactly in relation to the sixth seal do you see the Gog Magog invasion? Is it right before the seal or right after?
That's a good question because I haven't even answered that myself.
Well, let me ask you why. Let me explain why I'm asking.
Yeah.
It's because I know that in reference to Gog and Magog, the surrounding nations that join with Gog and Magog are going into a city of unwalled, an unwalled city that is dwelling in peace, as you mentioned earlier. But some of the other nations are looking at Gog and Magog and saying, what on earth are you doing? Mm-hmm. Are you coming in to take a spoil? They're shocked. This is a peaceful time. They're shocked that this army is on the move.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like an odd scene to take place if it's after a polar shift.
Which is a world in chaos. No, you're exactly right. This is one of the things that I've just tossed around in my head. Perhaps the wrath of God is brought about simply because he knows in men's hearts what they're planning. And I think this, in other words, what I'm saying is perhaps God preempts the invaders. And perhaps... It's hard. There are definitely...
Well, except that we have the reference to the blood coming up to the bridles.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's... I think that's... in Revelation, that's talking about... And I think that's also in Joel. I think that's talking about at the end of the seven-year period.
Okay, that could be.
Yeah.
I don't have my Bible in front of me, so I apologize if I'm wrong
there. But let me just look at the words it says right when it begins. Okay. Ezekiel 38:18. It will come about on that day when God comes against the land of Israel that my fury will mount up in my anger. It's hard to say exactly what happens first exactly.
What I find interesting about this too, let me just say this really quickly, is that the Bible's very clear that it's God who brings this invasion.
Yes,
he says, I will put hooks into your jaws and pull you forward toward my people.
Right. Well, I think what happens, I believe, is I think that it's... Now, this ties in with some of my other stuff on Muslim fundamentalism and the whole Islamic movement. I see these ties between all these nations that come against Israel. The common denominator is a group called the Muslim Brotherhood.
That is so true.
This is a group that is really like an international Muslim mafia, and they've been used by the United States in the past to get their way in the Middle East. They're very entrenched within Britain. I think they have a voice in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what's going to happen is that this plan will be arrived at. There's a specific verse I'm looking for when it talks about these nations conspiring. It's like they have an evil plan and they're conspiring ahead of time, and this is what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think the hooks in the jaws part is simply God saying, you have your own plan about when and where you want to do it, but
mm-hmm.
I want you to do it now. You're going to do it right now. God is able to say, this is now. You have to act now. And I think there's one way to view it, and it's hard to try and put the pieces together, but perhaps this invasion happens right after the polar shift, when this collection of armies says it's now or never. Because also the other thing is, this thing would never come about with the United States being the military power that it is today.
That's
imagine
a good
what
point.
Would just imagine what would happen after a polar shift. I mean, we have all of our, all of our communications equipment, all of our navigation equipment, all of our bombs, our stealth guys, even our tanks are hooked up with global positioning satellites and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. What would happen after a polar shift type event? All that stuff would be
usually recalibrated, useless. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We're talking with author Peter D. Goodgame about his book, Red Moon Rising, The Rapture and the Timeline of the Apocalypse, and we're just about to blow up the nation of Israel as the invaders led by Gog of Magog are preparing possibly to take advantage of a global catastrophe, a polar shift or some such thing that maybe wipes the United States out of the picture. Possibly the Yellowstone caldera picks that moment to blow up. Peter, you were making the point that the United States, as long as it's able to defend Israel, is probably going to hold back anyone with ideas of invasion.
I would think so.
But yes. In the confusion following a global catastrophe like a polar shift or the incidents that would follow the opening of the sixth seal,
right.
You know, the falling
mm-hmm.
stars and so forth, that a nation with, or a group, rather, of nations, or a group within nations
mm-hmm.
with designs on Israel might pick that moment to try to invade. And that is when God would step in then to save the nation of Israel in what is obviously a supernatural intervention?
Very much so, yes.
Well, you know, the book of Revelation starts out, of course, with the letters to the churches. And in chapter 6, is it? We get into the four horsemen. Well, anyway,
yes, right.
Chapter six
begins with, and then the first five seals all go by very quickly.
Exactly, and the first four are these four horsemen that everybody probably,
right.
Whether you're a Christian or not, you've heard of the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think these four horsemen line up if they don't start with year one of the 7-year end time
period? Yes, okay. This is the question. In other words, the pre-trib chronology places the beginning of the 7-year tribulation and the beginning of the day of the Lord with the first seal. And then they place the rapture as the 24 elders, like everybody's taught.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I look at it differently. I think the first four seals can best be understood as the birth pangs of the apocalypse. And this Jesus explains this in his Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24.
Mm-hmm.
I think they line up very well. This is another thing that the pre-wrath teachers came up with, and I think they're correct. The only thing is they place the birth pangs, for whatever reason, they place the birth pangs within the 7-year tribulation. I think that didn't make sense to me. I think these birth pangs are leading up to the beginning of the apocalypse. And after this double impact that begins the apocalypse is when the 7-year period begins. So, yes, I put the 7-year tribulation after the fourth trumpet, I would say. And so the first four seals, now, the first seal itself, okay, a lot of people say that this is the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the descriptions of Satan and the descriptions of the beast throughout the book of Revelation, the seven heads,
mm-hmm.
and then Revelation 17 describes them as saying that they are seven kings. I believe those are literal kings, not kingdoms, like so many other people believe. And the angel explains these kings, saying that five have fallen, one is yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
And the Antichrist is an eighth who is one of the seven. I believe that this people really focus on the Antichrist, they forget about the seventh king, okay? The seventh king is something, and let me just read this short description of the seventh king. Let's see. Okay, there are seven kings, five have fallen. One is, I think the one that is at John's time was probably Nero. The other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the seventh king would have a short reign, but I believe that the seventh king was the first seal, was the what most people view as a false Christ. I don't think it's a false Christ. In a certain sense, it could be a false Christ, but it just says, I looked and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow,
mm-hmm.
and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if we take those together, it says that this seventh king is given authority, he's given, you know, something to rule, and he goes out as a conqueror, but he exists only for a little while. I think this describes the career of Hitler. That's how I view it. And I believe that when we look at, over the past 2,000 years, it's been Christianity has dominated. I think these first five kings are all blasphemous pagan kings from before,
mm-hmm.
okay, beginning with Nimrod.
Mm-hmm.
And on down, number five would have been Antiochus Epiphanes. I think that we really had a blatant reversion back to paganism only through the career of Hitler. That was the first time it resurfaced.
He certainly was involved in it.
The Nazi Party was more of a cult than it was a political party.
And you know, we're seeing the ripple effect from that here in the United States. So if the first horseman is Hitler...
I would say that the first horseman is Hitler. The second horseman, it simply says... A second living creature said, "Come," and another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. I think this great terrible war that it's talking about, the ability to take peace from the earth, the power to take peace and to make men slay one another, I think that's talking about the Second World War, which was the greatest global conflict by far, and the aftermath, of course, led to the establishment of the nation of Israel. So I think it was hugely prophetically significant, and I think that's what it's talking about.
Oh, yeah, and I wonder if that great sword could be the atomic bomb.
Perhaps, definitely. That's the first time I heard that. That's actually, I'll be using that in the future.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. That's a good point there.
And then the third horseman goes out, and that one is
the third seal, I think, is talking about a lack of justice on an economic level.
Right.
Okay? And it's talking about a discrepancy between those at the bottom and those on the top. A quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine, okay? It's talking about, you know, the majority of the world is working as hard as it can, as hard as it can just to feed itself day to day, okay? And then on the other hand, you have a group saying, do not damage the oil and the wine. Obviously, when you look at oil, you look at the West, specifically the United States, and it's all about the economy, and once the economy's going well, all we worry about is being entertained and inebriated for most of us.
That's a very good point.
That is a very good point. And, of course, if you don't understand the old denarius, as I remember, that's a day's wages for essentially a loaf of bread.
Right, exactly.
That's an expensive loaf of bread.
Yeah, it's a very expensive loaf of bread.
Yeah, and an interesting thing, too, is that in John's day, when you're talking about oil, you're talking about olive oil, but in today's economy, that has a whole different connotation.
It does.
And it still applies.
So the rich gets richer, and the poor get poorer, and then the fourth horseman comes out.
And then the fourth horseman, yes. I think this is talking about the effects of what I refer to as a third seal as an unjust economic order, and it's an order that has been dictated by us, by the United States, in league with the British to a large extent, and it's the process of neo-colonialism where, you know, the big business has taken over control of all the economies, and sovereign nations have been neutralized. There is no more sovereignty for third world nations. They're totally dependent on handouts from the West, and then we look at them and we think we're so nice for helping them out. Well, we kind of created the situation that they're in to begin with. Anyway, the situation that they're in is they're dealing with sword and with famine and with pestilence by the wild beasts of the earth, which is what the fourth seal talks about. This is the worst parts of Africa, where it's constant civil war, you know, constant famine, diseases running rampant. When it says a fourth of the earth, I think it's talking about geographically. It's talking about the poorest quarter of the earth where these terrible conditions exist.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how the four horsemen of the apocalypse really do parallel Matthew 24, where Jesus is talking about the signs before the end of day.
Yes.
Well, let me jump backwards at this point, not to throw us off of, you know, a cohesive timeline here, thread. But one of Jesus' prophecies was, as Sharon mentioned earlier, to tell people when they saw the abomination that causes desolation, that they should just run. Now, a lot of Christians who were living in Jerusalem when the Romans attacked in AD 70 took it to mean the sight of Roman legions outside the walls of Jerusalem, and they got out and headed for the hills. There are a lot of Christians who believe that everything in Revelation is already fulfilled, and that was the abomination of desolation, Titus outside the walls of Jerusalem in AD 70. How do you answer that?
Well, it's funny because I have an old friend who's a firm pre-wrath guy, but at the end of our debates, we always laugh at each other and go, ha ha, okay, whatever. At least we're not preterists.
We know what that means. You want to explain to our listeners what a preterist is?
Oh, boy. They're a very ornery bunch, I tell you. But, as far as that specific thing, I take Arnold Fruchtenbaum's view. I think that if you look at the Olivet Discourse, you can find where you can find the distinction between. I do believe that Jesus did talk about what would happen in 70 AD and predict it and give instructions.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
He did. Yeah.
Yes, but scholars have to separate that from the separate instructions that he gave to the Jews living at the end time.
Right, and actually, what he said was not unusual for a prophet. And, you know, because in addition to being the Son of God and our Redeemer, he also spoke as a prophet.
Yes.
And that was the prophecy often had an immediate fulfillment, plus a future one.
Well, I think he gave two separate prophecies, though, and that's what scholars don't understand. I don't think there was one prophecy with dual fulfillment. I do believe, and this is what Arnold Fruchtenmaul says, is he gives two different descriptions. There are differences there. I think if you have to compare the difference between Luke and Matthew, I believe, or something like that.
Okay.
But that would be my view. But as far as preterism, it's hard to say, you know, what the best way is to address it. I really just think that you've got to understand that there's a gap between the 69th and the 70th week, and you got to understand that the 70th week comes at the end. So if that 7-year period does come at the end, which, you know, it very clearly does in Revelation with these references to 42 months, 1260 days, times, and half a time, you know, if that's it, then the futurist perspective, that's the only way to make sense of it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
where was Jesus? I mean, did we miss him?
Yeah,
preterist view. Someone made another good point, too, is that the General Titus never set foot inside the temple because his soldiers set it on fire before he could get to it. So he never had a chance to set up the abomination that causes desolation.
Exactly.
Right, right.
Well, Antiochus Epiphanes is the one who did that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, 200 B.C. That
right,
was,
exactly. Yeah. And he set up the statue of Zeus.
Yes.
In the temple.
No.
And it could be that the statue that the false prophet makes to...
Sacrificed a pig, I believe.
He did indeed on the altar. That was bad.
Yeah, and prophesied by Daniel. Prophesied by Daniel.
Yeah, prophesied by Daniel.
We're talking with author Peter D. Goodgame, his book, The Red Moon Rising, The Rapture, and the Timeline of the Apocalypse. And we are getting right down to the brass tacks here, the final 7 years. Now, you kind of nailed the midpoint first of the 7-year final week of Daniel. And then how do you then back it up and then nail down when it begins, when it ends, and what happens during that period of time?
Yes, just to go over it again quickly, at the beginning of the 70th week, I believe, begins after the fourth trumpet. This is a lot different than most people have been teaching, but I think it happens after the fourth trumpet. It happens after the apocalypse begins itself, okay? You've got the day of the Lord followed by this collection of judgments that come from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I tie both of these things in with the Magog invasion.
Right, okay.
And in Ezekiel, we have that very enigmatic 7-year period. I don't think there's a mystery here. I think the 7-year period in Ezekiel is the 7-year period of Daniel's 70th week. So that's where I put the 7-year tribulation. It's all the way after the fourth trumpet.
Mm-hmm. And the 7-year period is when Israel cleans up after the invasion.
Yes.
And they burn the instruments of war for 7 years.
For fuel, yes.
Yeah.
And who knows how much of a collection they had. Maybe they had enough gathered to last them for 100 years. The point is they burn them for 7 years because, and this is a proof text from prophecies in Isaiah and elsewhere that say that when the millennial kingdom is established, that all the weapons of war will be turned into agricultural equipment.
Mm-hmm.
It says that your swords will become plowshares and your shields pruning hooks.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ezekiel says all these things are collected and used for fuel. If they're being made into equipment, they can't be used for fuel. So that's why I think that this 7-year period has to end before before the second coming. Some people place it, you know, 3.5 years into the millennial kingdom, but I don't think that's possible.
So what would then be the political and religious implications or, let's say, of this foiled invasion of Israel?
Yes, that's the thing. I think in the aftermath of this invasion, in the aftermath of this double impact, okay, at the beginning of the apocalypse, I think the stage is set for Israel to, first of all, become more religious, okay? They're going to, I think this is when we're going to see the third temple completed, if not, you know, begun from scratch, because the people will know that that they have been divinely saved, you know? But I also think that it creates the scene where the Antichrist is going to appear and the false prophet. And I believe that the false prophet comes from Rome. I believe the false prophet is this Roman prince that signs this covenant with Israel that begins the actual seven-year period itself. So
now, the Vatican has been working to acquire property in Jerusalem, has it not?
They have, yeah.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah.
This is Barry Kamish. He's an Israeli investigative journalist. He's onto the story, and he updates every month, and he has a number of articles where he goes into this. Yes, the Vatican.
That's right. That's where I saw it. I saw it at his website. Now, do you have thoughts as to where the Antichrist, the one who comes up with the 7-year peace plan for Israel, might come from?
This is another show. This is what I'm working on. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag.
Okay, well, I don't want to do that. I do want to ask you, and you and I have talked about this before, the notion that the Muslim eschatology talks about al-Mahdi and how he is going to be he's the equivalent of Jesus in Christian eschatology, end time theology. They see Jesus, whom they call Isa, coming first into Jerusalem and proclaiming, everybody worship this guy, and pointing to the al-Mahdi, the 12th imam. And it's almost as if Jesus takes the position of the false prophet.
Well, Islam is definitely headed for its day of reckoning, and I'm not sure how, you know, their prophecies are all going to play out. I'm not an expert. Mike Heiser has written a book on the Islamic connection to Bible prophecy. But what I do believe is that, again, just like within the Roman Catholic Church, you know, the hierarchy is corrupt. But there are some good Catholics. I believe that there are some good Muslims. I'm not saying saved Muslims. I'm just saying good Muslims. And I believe that in the Old Testament, we have a number of texts, especially Daniel, that give the impression that when the Antichrist finally does come and gain power, that some of his greatest enemies will come from the Muslim world. And especially in Isaiah 19, when it talks about how at the end time, after it's all over with, God has a special blessing for Egypt and for Syria.
Mm-hmm.
These are two Muslim nations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I do believe that, yes, a great portion of the Muslim world will be deceived, but there will be another portion that will see through the deception and will fight through it. And
that's interesting. Well, we've placed almost all of the pieces in the timeline.
I always run short one piece, so.
Well, let's not leave that piece out of the puzzle here. Yeah,
under the couch. That's where it is.
That's right. Let's pull the piece from underneath the couch. Most of the different theories are named. Yeah, you know, for the timeline of the apocalypse are named for the placement in the timeline of the rapture. Pre-trib, post-trib, mid-trib. Pre-wrath now. So where do you place the rapture in the timeline of the apocalypse?
Okay, well, I technically you could call my model a pre-trib model, and I don't object to that at all. But I call it the Red Moon Rapture model, simply because that tells you right exactly where it happens, because you have the Red Moon again, the opening of the sixth seal.
So the beginning of the day of the Lord.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I also believe that the Bible really makes a connection there between the Day of the Lord and the Rapture. You can't make a disconnection there.
Mm-hmm.
Like Arnold Fruchtenbaum, who I admire greatly, he says that there's a possible length of time there between the Rapture and the Day of the Lord. He said it could be a few days, a few months, could be years.
Yeah, I've heard that.
That's necessary if you view, you know, an imminent rapture, and if you also view that the Day of the Lord begins with the first seal. It's necessary to uphold their chronology. But For me, as far as placing this, I look to the words of Paul, 1 Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, this verse here. It simply says, "For God did not appoint us to suffer wrath, but to receive salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ." And I see this fulfilled in the two pictures that are painted for us in the book of Revelation after the sixth seal. We have, on one hand, somebody is going to suffer wrath. On the other hand, someone is going to receive salvation. Those are the two options.
Mm-hmm.
And after the sixth seal happens, what happens to the unbelievers? They say, "Fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath is come, and who is able to stand?" That's where the wrath part is fulfilled. The salvation part is fulfilled with the picture of the great multitude.
And that's okay. The fifth seal?
This is after the sixth seal.
What is seal number 5? I don't think we talked about that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. The fifth seal is the martyrs, when the martyrs cry out.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. That are being martyred even now.
They ask for God's judgment upon the earth.
Right. And I think we talked about this as well, because they're asking, how long do we have to wait for you to go
and
avenge us?
They've been there quite a while. And the pre-tribute is that this is tribulation martyrs.
Right.
They died during a 7-year period.
But they'd know exactly how long they had to wait.
Yeah, they're very impatient, these martyrs.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. That's a very good clue, yeah.
Yes, yes. And then at the end, I break this down into a 4-part outline. At the very end is when they receive a gift. At the very end of this description of the fifth seal, they're given a white robe, and I think this white robe either signifies the resurrection, which takes place before the rapture, or it's them getting ready for the resurrection, because you know Paul is clear that the souls that are in heaven will be reunited with the bodies that are buried on earth, and that
right.
Together the departed will meet those who are alive and are raptured in the air. I think that's what the fifth seal is pointing to. And then I believe that as soon as Jesus opens the sixth seal, right after that happens, in a twinkling of an eye, is when he will descend to the earth's atmosphere and gather the living and the dead and then take them back to heaven. And then they appear in heaven after these events are described. See, you have to look at John's perspective. He's looking, after the sixth seal is open, he's looking at the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, when he, you know, is able to break away from what he's witnessing on earth, he turns to heaven and he sees, oh, check it out, I'm surrounded by this great multitude.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that this great multitude cries out, "Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." That's the salvation part of Paul's brief little statement there. Okay, you have wrath for one group, you have salvation for the other. And then, by the way, as far as their description, the characterization saying that they have come out of the great tribulation,
mm-hmm.
I interpret that as, and I go into this into my book at more length, but they are someone who has been rescued away from the great tribulation. They did not experience the tribulation.
Right, and there you have to look at the original language and see what it says.
Yes. And you can compare it with that. The same characterization is given in descriptions of Lot at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The same sort of wording is used, and it says that Lot was taken out of the midst of the destruction. He didn't experience it. He was rescued from it right when it began. It's the same thing that happens with this great multitude.
That's right.
Hmm.
Hey, let me ask you a question that some of our well-versed eschatologists might be thinking right now.
Yes.
I know it's crossed my mind. There's a verse later on in Revelation that talks about the strong angel with a sharp sickle.
Yeah.
Who is ordered to thrust in a sharp sickle. But before that, there is an order to gather the elect. I think it's before. I don't have it in front of me. Gather the elect from the four corners.
Yes. Well, that is where Jesus, you'll find that in Jesus' statement in Matthew 24. He talks about, and this is where the pre-wrath chronology gets all mixed up, because they put these, what Jesus is describing of his own second coming, they apply that to the sixth seal. What Jesus was talking about happens at the end of the tribulation, at the very end,
mm-hmm.
and not at the beginning. Now, as far as the gathering of the elect, I think with the trumpet, I think that that is found in Isaiah. I forget the specific text, but it talks about the same thing. And Isaiah makes it clear that the elect in this context are the Jews, when the saved nation.
See, that's
Israel.
What I think too.
Yeah.
I think the elect
yeah.
are the Jews at that point.
Yes,
because it's very clear. God he gave 69 weeks, you know, for him to really pay attention to what the Jewish nation was doing, what Israel was doing. And then once they rejected Christ as he came through on Palm Sunday, they said, nope, he turned his mind toward the Gentile nations. Praise God. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of that last week, he goes back to the 70-week timeline and once again turns his thought.
Exactly.
You know, well, his mind is never. I mean, he thinks about every one of us always. It isn't that.
Right.
But the plan goes back into effect. It's almost as if we're parentheses.
Right. As Gabriel said to Daniel, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city.
Right.
Yeah. So the 70th has not yet been fulfilled. Yeah. We're running out of time, Peter, but one other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think your analysis is really different from what I've heard before, and that's for the identity of the two witnesses who come down and really torment those who are left behind for 3.5 years before they're killed and then resurrected.
I had never heard these two names before. You got to tell people who you think they are.
Well, I think I go to the Old Testament again, and I think the names are Joshua and Zerubbabel, and most people would respond like Patrick
Heron
said to me in Roswell. Patrick Heron was like, Joshua and Zerubbabel, I've never heard of them. Well, come on, Patrick, do your homework, man. Figure it out. Anyway, this is where I go back to the Old Testament. There's a specific prophecy at the end of the book of Haggai, and it says. It's a message to Haggai the prophet. God says, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I am going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and destroy the power of the kingdoms of the nations, and I will overthrow the chariots and the riders, and the horses and the riders will go down, everyone by the sword of another. On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, my servant, and I will make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you. Now, I think when he's talking about on that day, he's talking about the day of the Lord. And this list of events here, talking about shaking the heavens and the earth, overthrowing the thrones of kingdoms. And then when he talks about, I will overthrow the chariots and their riders, everyone by the sword of another. This is talking about an army being struck with madness, fighting among itself. You find the very same description in Ezekiel 38 and 39. I believe that this is talking about the Magog invasion. And he says that on that day, at that time, I will make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you. So I think Zerubbabel is one of the two witnesses. The other is Joshua. And we have to look a couple chapters over in Zechariah chapter 3. And there's a description of what I believe is Joshua going through what is known the Bema Seat judgment of Jesus Christ that Paul referred to. This is when every believer will be judged according to his works. It's not a judgment of condemnation. It's simply a judgment of rewards. In other words, everybody's saved who appears at this judgment. But you're going to have to give an account of how you've used your gifts for the Lord. And Paul is clear that everything negative, everything bad, everything that wasn't used in a positive way is going to be burned up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then at the end of this judgment, we're going to receive rewards. One of them is, a number of them are crowns that are mentioned. And also, Paul talks about how after this judgment, everybody puts on clean robes. It's like their body is changed as well. This is all connected in with the rapture and the resurrection as well. And then you have white garments, with the great multitude wears. Anyway, I believe that Zechariah gives a description of something that could only happen in an end times context, when it talks about there's Satan standing at his right hand. And then it says something very interesting. It says, indeed, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire? The fire is talking about the fire that comes. It's this cleansing fire that burns away all the bad works.
Mm-hmm.
And the other point, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem. This is talking about the return to the 70th week timeline, the return to the 70 weeks that were given to God's people and to his holy city. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem. This happens, and we know that the two witnesses minister in the first half of the 1260 days of the first half of the seven-year period.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So right here, this is when God has chosen Jerusalem. This is when the 1260 days start for the two witnesses, and Joshua is one of them. And then I really think it all comes home in chapter 4 when it describes the two lampstands. And it really refers to, I believe it mentions Zerubbabel by name, but in the context, I think it's also got the other person has to be Joshua, because he was just talking about Joshua. So when he says, these are the two anointed ones who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth, he's talking about Joshua and Zerubbabel, and that's the very same terms used to describe the two witnesses in Revelation 11.
That's really interesting. It really is. You know what interests me about that as well is Zerubbabel, you said signet. With Joshua, you were talking about the brand plucked from the fire to cleanse the fire. Both of these are used to mark. A signet ring, mark.
And a brand.
A brand, mark. What do you see in the very beginning of the 7 years?
Yeah.
We're marking. We got to seal up those 144,000 witnesses.
Good point.
The other point is that Joshua and Zerubbabel were involved in rebuilding Solomon's temple. And in Zechariah chapter 4, we also talk about the temple being rebuilt.
It's Joshua like, was?
Well, not Joshua.
Zerubbabel.
Zerubbabel.
Oh, I thought you said Joshua and Zerubbabel.
I might have. I'm sorry. Let me read chapter 4, verse 9. It says, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you.
Ooh, that gives you chills.
Good catch.
Yeah, perhaps, perhaps these guys appear on the scene, right, when Israel needs, you know, some of the information because, you know, the Sanhedrin's already reconstituted.
Yep.
The Temple Institute is going at it, you know, full bore, although they don't have the backing of the public, you know. These guys are going to appear on the scene at a very opportune time.
Yep, and of course,
they're going to tell the Jews that we've already seen the Messiah.
Yeah.
He's at the right hand of the Lord.
Hmm.
That is amazing. Well, I wish we had days and days to talk about this, but we are running out of time.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Red Moon Rising is the book, and that's also the website, redmoonrising.com. In addition to the book, which you can purchase there or through, I presume, Amazon.com or any of the online bookstores?
Yes.
Okay. You can also read Peter's other articles. He's done some great research on the history of the occult, really, stemming from Nimrod and the Tower of Babel and, you know, continuing on through the present day. Just some fascinating stuff there. Links to some other good sites like the website of Barry Kamish and his articles from Israel. And, boy, it's just real good meat for developing a better understanding of what is coming. You know, God's left it there in his word, a roadmap. We see, you know, through the glass darkly, but Peter, you've helped scrub off a little of the
of
the haze, and we appreciate it. Thank you for being with us on PID Radio.
I appreciate you guys very much. You guys are doing a real good thing, a real good service for people like me. Your show is very, very good, and I wish you guys all the best.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. God bless you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Over 6,000 years ago, the citizens of Mesopotamia encountered them.
Down through time, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world have etched their likeness on the walls of caves, chiseled statues of them from solid stone, and prayed prayers to their highest gods to be delivered from them.
But prophecy says they will return. And at a time when Babylon, modern Iraq, and Iran is invaded and destroyed, This spring, exclusively from RaidersNewsUpdate.com, we'll tell you what you need to know about them. In the book-length ebook, Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal.
In the 14th century, the Black Death killed nearly one-third the population of Europe. In 1918, the Spanish flu killed as many as 100 million people. The next great plague may already be spreading. Inspired by today's headlines, it's the Armageddon Strain, the explosive new thriller from Sharon K. Gilbert. At a laboratory somewhere in the desert southwest, a secretive group has created a deadly virus for a single purpose, to eliminate 90% of human life. Standing in their way is Dr. Maggie Taylor, a woman broken by grief and alcohol, who must somehow find the strength to unravel the mystery of her father's death in time to stop the virus from being released. Infuse magazine says Sharon Gilbert has a talent for making you feel good, scared, on the edge of your seat, and dying for more. And Christian Fiction Review says Sharon Gilbert does a very nice job of building suspense and horror step by step. The Armageddon Strain from Sharon K. Gilbert, the newest release in the Myth Arc, the ultimate battle for mankind. Available now online and at bookstores everywhere.